Hello, everyone. I'm Megan Sullivan, and welcome to History and Games, a podcast series that celebrates the educational power of video games by studying the real stories in history hidden inside our favorite games. In this special two-part episode of History and Games, I'll first talk about Oklos, developed by Coffee Powered Machine and published by Digital Devolver, and its connection to the outrageous, over-the-top origins of Western democracy. Then, in the second episode, I'll be speaking with Professor Josiah Ober of the University of Stanford about not only the crazy origins of democracy, but about whether or not modern democracies around the world are in danger. I just finished my interview with Professor Ober a little earlier, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy this two-part episode. But before I start, a reminder that if you enjoy History and Games, please be sure to follow me on your favorite audio platform and on YouTube at History and Games, all one word. And if you can, I'd really appreciate your support on Patreon at patreon.com/MEGHANR Sullivan, because that allows me to pay the bills while I create what I hope are entertaining and educational experiences. Thank you. So, what is Oklos? Well, it's an entertaining pixelated mob simulator, Oklos actually means mob in Greek, that sees you guiding the hoi polloi, the unruly masses of ancient Greece around town, smashing anything and everything in their way as they attempt to free themselves from the control of abusive Greek deities. Led by a charismatic philosopher, that's you, the mob must not only take on the gods themselves, but any monsters and baddies the Olympians throw your way. Luckily, this mob includes a handful of Greek heroes to even the odds, although in order to make way for them, a few commoners might have to get booted from the crowd. While you're smashing things, convincing heroes and philosophers to join in on the fun, and picking fights with legendary beings, you can educate yourself about ancient Greece by visiting the game's wonderfully informative compodium. I really like this feature. Talk about a fun way to learn. But this very straightforward, very cathartic game has another hidden educational component that may come as a surprise. Oklos' gameplay accurately reflects the shocking Western origins of democracy, which is what I want to talk about today. Why? It's utterly fascinating. You see, democracy didn't start with a smile and a hearty handshake. Demos, people, kratos, power, started with a murder. In 514 BCE, just as rosy-fingered dawn appeared on the horizon, a man stood outside the Leocorium Gate of Athens. There, plucking at his robes and fiddling with a myrtle wreath atop his head, he may have felt slightly anxious while overseeing the last-minute preparations for the upcoming parade that marked the final day of the Panathenaea, a yearly festival that brought the people living in and around Athens together to celebrate the city-state's patron goddess of war and wisdom, Athena, or as it would have said in the 6th century BCE, Athene. Every fourth year, the festival was especially grand, and the highlight of the parade featured a spectacular float, a ship whose sail was in fact a newly spun gown for the statue of Athena, which was situated on the Acropolis, the rocky Bronze Age citadel whose name means High City. Once the ship quote-unquote sailed to its destination, the gown was ceremoniously hung on the statue of the goddess, and a sacrificial feast commenced. Overseeing the final preparations for the big parade should have been an exciting moment. Yet Hipparchus, son of the former tyrant of Athens, Pisistratus, was distracted. According to the historian Herodotus, he had recently had an ominous dream which foretold he would be forced to, quote, endure the unendurable. If true, he must have felt very nervous and alone. He was not alone, however. Walking towards him were men also dressed in festive clothing. They too fiddled with the myrtle crowns atop their head, though not for the same reason. Hidden inside the thick, sweet-scented branches that crowned each man's head was a sword, normally only carried about for ceremonial purposes during the festival. But these swords would be put to use. Just as Hipparchus was looking over the ceremonial float, the gang of men, led by a pair of aristocrats named Aristogeton and Harmodius, unsheathed their swords and cut down Hipparchus in cold blood. Why? Well, the historian Thucydides tells us that the whole thing started over a lover's quarrel. According to the author, Hipparchus aggressively courted the handsome young Harmodius, who rejected him in favor of Aristogeton. Hipparchus then handled this rejection by publicly insulting and humiliating Harmodius's sister, which led to Aristogeiton and Harmodius vowing revenge and hatching a plan to kill Hipparchus. Herodotus, however, the ancient world's original gossip girl, says nothing about a love triangle, only that a number of conspirators murdered Hipparchus in cold blood, and that this started a civil war among the nobility. Neither historian agrees as to whether Hipparchus or his brother Hippias was a current tyrant of Athens at the time, but they do agree that after Hipparchus was murdered, Hippias fled to the safety of the Acropolis, and from there had his followers begin dealing out terrible punishment to the conspirators. For example, Harmonius had been killed in the initial scuffle with Hipparchus, but Aristogeiton was captured by Hippias's men and tortured to death. Hippias then rooted out more conspirators and had them all executed and thrown into the city's criminal pit. A late source from antiquity even claims a courtesan was captured in an attempt to force her to give up the names of more conspirators, but that she bit off her own tongue rather than give them up. The tyrant didn't stop there, though. He began to clamp down hard on the populace as well. Now, originally, the word tyrant simply meant a man who had managed to overthrow an unpopular government, often with the approval of the masses. But Hippias's brutal actions redefined the word tyrant forever. For now, we associate the word with a bully or a despot, someone who abuses their power. And in fact, Hippias's rule became so harsh that a powerful Athenian clan, the Alcmaeonidae, whom the Pisistratid had exiled years before, ostensibly due to an ancient curse, but more likely due to their considerable influence in Athenian politics, felt confident enough to lead a rebellion against Hippias. Despite their best efforts, however, the Alcmaeonidae and their noble allies ended up getting the worst of it, and it was clear that if they were going to succeed, they needed outside help. It's here that the wily leader of the Alcmaeonidae, Cleisthenes, son of Megacles, now dramatically bursts into the spotlight. During the clan's latest exile, Cleisthenes had used his family's enormous wealth to help rebuild the temple of Apollo in Delphi after a devastating fire consumed it around 520 BCE. The Pythia, that is, the priestess of Delphi, whose oracles were sought out by the ancient world's most powerful leaders, was duly grateful. Fast forward to around 510 BCE, when after nearly half a decade of war with Hippias and his supporters, Cleisthenes finally decided to call in a favor and instructed the Pythia to encourage the Spartans, who made up ancient Greece's most formidable army, to come to the aid of the Athenians in their war against Hippias. And by Athenians, I really mean Athenian nobility. The hoi polloi at this point had no say in the matter. They were simply caught in the middle of it all. Now, at first, the Spartans were reluctant to obey. They were on good terms with the Pisistratid clan and didn't want to violate the laws of guest friendship, which was an important diplomatic tool in the ancient world. Yet, how could the ultra-conservative and deeply religious Spartans refuse an order from on high? Well, it turns out they couldn't. So after a false start in which a small Spartan contingent was ferried over to the beaches near Athens, but then beaten back by Hippias and his supporters, King Cleomenes of Sparta personally marched his best troops all the way to Athens and managed to not only steamroll all of Hippias' supporters, but force the tyrant himself to once again take refuge on the Acropolis. Now, Hippias might have been able to wait out the Spartan siege, since the ancient citadel he was hiding in had its own freshwater supply and stocks of food. Unfortunately, he made a major tactical blunder. While held up on the Acropolis, Hippias tried to sneak the rest of his family out of the city, but they were quickly captured by the alert Athenians and Spartans, who demanded that Hippias and his family leave the city within 5 days, or else. Would the Athenians truly have hurt Hippias' family? Maybe not. But throughout Herodotus's histories, King Cleomenes of Sparta would continually prove himself to be volatile and unpredictable. So much so that when he later dies a spectacularly gruesome death, men think it's simply because he's gone mad. So the threat to Hippias's family, at least coming from the Spartans, was very, very real. Thus, there was nothing the tyrant could do but leave Athens forever. And so, just like that, the tyranny of the Pisistratid came to an abrupt end. All's well that ends well, right? Oh, not even remotely. Things were now completely up in the air. Now that the tyrant was gone, who was in charge of Athens? Who was going to fill the vacant spot at the top? Two noblemen immediately stepped forward and offered to fill in the void, the wily Cleisthenes and Isagoras, a shadowy figure whom little is known, save he represented Spartan interests in Athens and was of noble stock. The two men were evenly matched in terms of qualifications and quickly arrived at an impasse. It's at this point that the hoi polloi finally got a say in matters, for it was now up to the male citizens of Athens to decide who they wanted to lead them. And I mean literally, as a near-century-old law forbade the masses from fence-sitting during a time of political crisis. At first, the people supported Isagoras. It's not clear why, since we know so little about him, but it may be that he was simply the safer bet. You see, Cleisthenes' grandfather and namesake was once a tyrant in a city-state west of Athens. So tyranny ran in Cleisthenes' blood, and that bloodline also happened to be cursed. As I discussed in my History and Games interview with Professor Sarah Isles Johnston, a curse, especially one associated with murder, could not only taint an entire family, but an entire city-state. Thus, Cleisthenes' leadership could prove disastrous for Athens. But Cleisthenes was more cunning than cursed. First, he must have reminded the Athenians his ancestors' malediction stemmed from trying to stop a would-be tyrant centuries before, although he may have failed to mention the family's murderous methods for doing so is exactly what led to the family curse. Cleisthenes also must have mentioned that he himself had no designs on becoming a tyrant. However, the wily leader of the Alcmaeonidae knew that wouldn't be enough to convince people to come over to his side. So, he offered the masses something irresistible, something they never had before, a real say in their own destiny. Cleisthenes' proposition was radical. He wanted to change the entire political landscape to reflect a more equal city-state. This meant redistricting in order to give people more say in political matters, enfranchising even the poorest citizens and those of only partial legal standing, expanding Athens' tribal hierarchy from 4 to 10 tribes to incorporate more people, and replacing the notion of permanent exile, which robbed citizens of their power and wealth, with a temporary ban known as ostracism, in which the quote-unquote winner of a special election got to keep their wealth and was merely banished from the city for 10 years. All of these reforms would fall under the title of good order or equality under the law. If this is what he offered, it's no wonder people wanted Cleisthenes as their new leader. But the rest of the nobility were horrified. You can't have the unwashed masses wielding that kind of power. Isagoras must have been especially horrified by these new reforms, because rather than try to match them, Isagoras went crying to his good friend King Cleomenes and demanded the Spartan king do something. Sensing an opportunity to install a Spartan puppet client in Athens, Cleomenes once again led troops into Athens. Once he arrived, he declared Isagoras the new leader along with 300 of Isagoras' hand-picked supporters who would help him run the city-state. But that wasn't all. At the suggestion of Isagoras himself, Cleomenes informed a whopping 700 Athenian families, including the Alcmaeonidae, that they were all permanently exiled from the city and were to leave right now. This proved to be too much for the Athenians, and not just the nobility. The masses themselves exploded in rage. It was bad enough Isagoras was instigating yet another round of intra-elite conflict, but now a foreign army was occupying Athens and dictating how the city-state should operate. Worse, if Isagoras and his cronies were in charge, it meant that Cleisthenes' reforms would never come to pass. Fearful of losing their promised freedom and furious that the Spartans were bullying them, a giant mob converged at the foot of the Acropolis and besieged Isagoras and the Spartans for days. Caught completely by surprise and unable to hold out indefinitely, Cleomenes was forced to take his small army and shamewalk out of the city. Meanwhile, Isagoras and his supporters were rounded up and summarily executed. The message was clear. Enough was enough, and it was time for a change. Yet even then, the Athenians still weren't completely free. The next year, a vengeful Cleomenes gathered a vast Spartan army, scooped up his nearby Peloponnesian allies, and marched them all on Athens, where he began to ravage the countryside west of the city. He also convinced Athens' northerly neighbor, the Boeotians, and their allies to join in on the attack from both the north and east, essentially boxing the Athenians in on all sides. This clever tactic might have worked, but when the Peloponnesians, along with Cleomenes' co-king, Demaratus, realized that Cleomenes was just out for personal revenge, they decided to abort the mission. His plans for vengeance thwarted, Cleomenes was forced to grit his teeth and follow them back home. Although it's possible, the Peloponnesians took one look at a massive army of Athenians and thought, man, they're ready to do battle and defend their new freedoms, maybe we should turn around and go home. With their western flank no longer threatened, the Athenians were free to focus their attention elsewhere and managed to win two separate battles against the Boeotians and their allies on the same day. This spectacular double victory gave the Athenians a tremendous boost in confidence. As a united people, they had bested the odds and proven that together, they could do anything. And this was only the beginning of the people's power movement. Two decades later, the Athenians, along with their allies the Plataeans, managed to beat back the Persian Empire at the famous Battle of Marathon. And just a decade later, a brilliant Athenian statesman named Themistocles encouraged the populace to invest in a navy using a cachet of silver found in one of the local mines. This investment almost immediately paid off, when just a short time later, the Persian Empire once again attempted to conquer mainland Greece. But instead of running into the Athenian army, this time Persia sailed right into the Athenian walls of Athens' fleet, manned by some of the city-state's poorest but most disciplined and determined men. For the Athenians, the result was a spectacular naval victory over the Persians in the Straits of Salamis. The people of Athens, the hoi polloi, were now unstoppable. Or were they? Though the Athenians and their Greek allies racked up a few more victories before finally breaking Persia's grip on Greece for good, it's clear that not all was well back in Athens. Though the people were able to flex their power on the high seas and in the army, their political clout was still limited, since the city's aristocrats managed to maintain a stranglehold on the most important and powerful branch of government, the Areopagos. The Areopagos was essentially the supreme court of Athens. Although its main function seems to have been to oversee trials involving homicide, this judiciary also had the ability to veto legislative decisions, ensuring that the court always had the last say in how Athens was governed. But sometime shortly after the Persian Wars ended, the court must have gone too far, because in the mid-460s BCE, an enthusiastic statesman named Ephialtes began introducing reforms to break the court's power. We don't know the details on how he did this, but we know it worked. In fact, maybe too well. Because around 461 BCE, Ephialtes was assassinated. To this day, nobody knows for sure who the culprit or culprits were, but it's likely the nobles of Athens, the ones who made up the majority of seats in the Areopagos, had a hand in the deed. Likely, they thought they could claw back power by getting rid of Ephialtes, but they were wrong, because now Ephialtes' deputy, a man named Pericles, would be the next to take up the democratic mantle. Under Pericles' reforms, the poor could now go to the theater for free, jurymen were paid so that they would show up to court, and the financial requirement to become an archon, or city leader, was lowered significantly. It was during this time that the term democracy, demos people plus kratos power, first came into use. Now, I could tell you that this is where the story ends, but it doesn't. Though the Athenians applauded democracy at home, abroad they were extremely imperialistic. After the Persian Wars, the Athenians invited their Greek allies to start a naval alliance with them. This alliance would be known as the Delian League, named after the island where the pact between city-states took place. But due to their superior number of ships, the Athenians began extracting money from their neighbors in order to fund the league. This caused a lot of resentment, especially since some of that money was being used by Pericles, no less, to fund expensive public projects back in Athens. Thus, some city-states began to rebel against the Athenians, but were severely punished in short order. Meanwhile, the mighty city-state of Sparta felt threatened by Athens' growing naval power, and by the mid-5th century BCE, the two city-states were set on a collision course. This collision would culminate in not one, but two Peloponnesian Wars, which took place on and off for nearly 50 years, and would take a terrible toll on everyone involved. It was a chaotic moment in time, and Athens' democracy began to fray under the stress of war. Then, when the Spartans finally won the conflict in the late 5th century BCE, Athens was forced to give up democracy altogether and accept an oligarchy made up of Athenian nobles who would do Sparta's bidding. Ironically, this was a successful version of what Cleomenes had tried to do a century before. However, the oligarchy was universally hated and only lasted about a year before the people once again rose up and reinstated people power. And people power would endure until, that is, the arrival of Philip of Macedon and his son Alexander, best known as Alexander the Great, in the mid-4th century BCE. These men were determined to bring all of Greece under one hegemony, and when the Athenians tried to reclaim their independence, Alexander crushed their efforts. After this, democracy would not exist in Athens for the next 2,000 years. It was an abrupt and tragic end to a fantastic social experiment in the ancient world. But the flames of democracy weren't entirely extinguished. The idea of people power held too much promise, too much potential. It briefly flared up in places like ancient Rome. And Herodotus makes the peculiar statement that after the Ionian Rebellion in the 490s BCE, a handful of democracies were established in Ionia on the west coast of what is now known as Turkey. And even when democracy seemed to disappear entirely from the ancient Western world, its ideals remained. This memory of democracy would eventually lay the foundation for newer, different types of democracies around the world, including ones in Britain, the United States, France, and finally, in 1974, democracy finally made its way back home to Greece. It's a good ending. But is it the end? Stay tuned for part two of this episode as I interview Professor Josiah Ober of the University of Stanford and ask him about the current, seemingly fragile state of democracy around the world. And that's it for this episode of History and Games. Questions, comments, suggestions? Email me at Megan, M-E-G-N, History, H-I-S-T-O-R-Y, @gmail.com, or leave a comment in the comment section below. Thanks so much for supporting History and Games, everyone. See you later.